from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this next Forum Hour, in April, Brooklyn-based poet and author Tracy K. Smith received the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry for her book, Life on Mars. It's a collection of poems which touches on childhood, the universe, and the loss of her late father, an engineer who worked on the Hubble telescope. Smith joins us to discuss the award, her writings, and why she looked to outer space to gain perspectives on issues close to home. Forum is coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. The Pulitzer Committee this year could not come to a decision on who ought to receive the award for fiction, but for poetry, they awarded it to a young Brooklyn-based Princeton creative writing professor named Tracy K. Smith, the author of three volumes of poetry, the most recent, a Grey Wolf Press published collection titled Life on Mars, which the Pulitzer Committee described as, quote, a collection of bold, skillful poems taking readers into the universe and moving them to an authentic mix of joy and pain, end quote. Author of Duende, which won the James Laughlin Award of the Academy of American Poets, and The Body's Question, winner of the Cave Canem Poetry Prize. She has received awards from the Rona Jaffe and Mrs. Giles Whiting Foundation and is a protege in the Rolex Mentor and Protege Arts Initiative. And she joins us for this forum hour. And so pleased to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
And congratulations on the Pulitzer.
Thank you.
It's sort of the afterglow at this point. How long has it came on your birthday, right?
It did. It came on, just about a month ago, and it's been a flurry, in a way, of just a realization and happy activity, I guess, since then.
Happy activity that doesn't seem to let up. Jennifer Egan, who's a friend of ours, for example, has been traveling all over the world, and it just hasn't stopped. So brace yourself. It's going to be
okay that
way. I wanted my listeners to get acquainted with your poetry, which I find quite stirring and versatile, I might add. Before I ask you to read anything, as much as there's this versatility, you even have a villanelle in here and a sonnet, and you write politically as well as personally, there's a good deal of what I would call popular culture, even a quote from Rush Limbaugh. But the popular culture is also in the title of your book, David Bowie.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess a while ago I gave myself permission to let anything that was important or of interest to me as a person into my poems. I think before that I'd been operating under the idea that certain elevated material was what I should be concerning myself with in a poem, and that just felt a little bit false to me.
When did that come upon you, that you could be free that way?
I think it probably happened when I was in graduate school. You know, you're working so hard to please your classmates and please your teachers and maybe to live up to this idealized standard of what you imagine a poet is. And after a certain point, if you're lucky, I think that kind of breaks down and you realize that there's a private investment at stake as well. And that becomes most important.
Well, I think I read where you described poetry as being investigations for you.
Yeah, I think of a poem as an opportunity to ask some questions and take my time in exploring possible routes toward an answer. Like, I don't even know if an answer is the most desirable endpoint, but the kind of exploration that a poem affords me is something that I really value.
As my listeners know, I'm a great believer in questioning, not necessarily with answers ahead of us. Could I get you to read one of your early poems in this collection? There's a whole second section devoted to your father, which I want to talk to you about. But I thought maybe we'd begin with It and Company, which is on page 17 in Life on Mars.
Sure. It and Company. We are a part of it, not guests. Is it us or what contains us? How can it be anything but an idea, something teetering on the spine of the number I? It is elegant, but coy. It avoids the blunt ends of our fingers as we point. We have gone looking for it everywhere, in Bibles and bandwidth, blooming like a wound from the ocean floor. Still, it resists the matter of false versus real. Unconvinced by our zeal, it is unappeasable. It is like some novels, vast and unreadable.
Yeah, I was really moved by that, especially since it covers such an extraordinary swath of antecedents with a capital I. It reminded me of a supposed suicide note of W.J. Cash. Forgive me, but it did make me think of that, because his suicide note said, "I can't stand it anymore, and I don't even know what it is."
I found that as I was writing these poems, it, the pronoun it, just kept inserting itself. And I realized I was, you know, I was searching for a sense of what it was that I wanted to believe my father had gone into in terms of the afterlife. But it also became something, an antecedent, something that had to do with what's urging or pushing us along. And I couldn't get away from this placeholder. And so I decided I had to kind of give it some proper space and investigate it a little bit.
Let's talk about your father, because he plays such a preeminent role in this volume, especially in the second section, which is really an elegy for him. An engineer on the Hubble, and someone who died back in 2008, and who came originally from black segregated Alabama. So to wind up being an engineer on the Hubble from those rather humble beginnings is sort of like going into outer space, really, isn't it?
I think so. Not that my father ever really phrased it like that for me when I was growing up, but when I look at the scope of his life now, it is really remarkable to me to see that that much history happened in such a short amount of time, actually. You know, to imagine that the living memory for people of his generation has gone through so many stark phases is pretty much like science fiction in some ways.
Tracy K. Smith with us, who is this year's Pulitzer Prize winner in poetry. Would you read The Speed of Belief, which is in memoriam for Floyd William Smith?
Sure.
Your father?
The Speed of Belief. I didn't want to wait on my knees in a room made quiet by waiting. A room where we'd listen for the rise of breath, the burble in his throat. I didn't want the orchids or the trays of food meant to fortify that silence, or to pray for him to stay, or to go then, finally, toward that ecstatic light. I didn't want to believe what we believe in those rooms, that we are blessed, letting go, letting someone, anyone, drag open the drapes and heave us back into our blinding, bright lives.
Yeah, that one gets me. and you read elegantly, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, a lot of poets don't quite have the intonation or the voice that you bring to this. Did your father get to know your work well? And did he give you the kind of feedback and appreciation one hopes for from a father one loves?
My father saw my first two books published. And I think that he became more comfortable in the world of my poetry. Not that I think he understood every single detail. My father was somebody who was more at home reading, you know, Longfellow or Wordsworth. And I think some of the tics of contemporary poetry were off-putting to him. And maybe that's one reason why some of my poems, or maybe many of my poems, seek to use language that's really familiar and transparent, and to let the mystery of the poem happen under the surface.
But he was a reader of poetry.
He was. He was a reader of everything. I remember, you know, there's so many memories of my father with a book in his hand. Even I think there's one family portrait of us in which somehow my father is holding a book while the rest of us are smiling at the camera. So, yeah, he was somebody who was in love with words and where they could take him.
There's a poem you have in here called My God, It's Full of Stars, and that's actually from Arthur Clarke's novelization of 2001, A Space Odyssey. So, again, you're playing with, and I think playing is the right word, isn't it, with a lot of space metaphors in popular culture.
Absolutely, yeah. I guess I was trying to figure out a few different things. When I first started writing these poems, I was thinking about America, and I thought that science fiction might be a helpful lens to think about some of the recent events or trends that I was interested in and maybe troubled by. And it seemed right to bring in high and low references. Like for me, Kubrick's 2001 would be a high reference. I think that film is so majestic. And then something that doesn't live up to that standard of beauty, like some of the Charlton Heston sci-fi films from the 60s and 70s also seem to want to fit into that widescreen gaze.
Yeah, I kept thinking about Mars Attacks by Tim Burton and The Face on Mars and Ray Bradbury's work and all those kinds mm-hmm. of things were flooding my consciousness. But I also thought about what you communicate so well, which is the awe in the space, stellar canopy, heavens, the vastness of it, the impenetrability of it or unknowable mystery of it, but also the dark side, just of being human.
Yeah. I think the dark side came first for me. I was thinking, you know, socially, politically, as a citizen. And the largeness and the wonder was something that really pushed its way in. And I think largely that was a result of Elegy becoming a mode that I needed to turn to. And suddenly, you know, this convenient lens that science fiction had provided gave way to something that really changed the scale of the questions that I was asking and asked me to maybe even look toward myself as opposed to at the headlines.
Well, you're willing to look inward in the old, often labeled confessional mode, which Garrison Keillor told me years ago should be retired. But also, you're willing to look outside. And I mean, there's a lot here about things like Abu Ghraib and crises in East Africa and the Austrian father who kept his daughter and her children in prison and sexually abused her. I mean, these are things that come into your poetry.
Yeah. Well, they're things that come into my point of view. You know, I read the newspaper. I listen to the radio. I'm bothered by the fact that I'm one way or another complicit in a world or society in which these things continue to happen. And
why do you say you're complicit? Why
well, I have this idea that, you know, not that I'm a proponent of that kind of like depravity, but I feel like when we live inside of our lives with comfort and allegiance to certain things that allow other things that we don't like to happen, we're complicit, you know. And I think that it's important to acknowledge that and maybe to start to question why it's so easy to be that way.
But you're also mindful, it seems to me, of just the beauty of some of these, well, and the humbling nature of some of the images we get back, say, from the Hubble.
Yeah. Those images to me are, they look like paintings, you know. They look exactly like something that the imagination, you know, invented to try and capture what space could look like. I see them and I can't not imagine something watching back or something that's capable of comprehending these large patterns that we haven't even yet recognized. It's kind of just splendid and
stunning.
Stunning, yeah. Stultifying, I was going to say, but yeah.
I was just being alliterative. You know, it happens to me sometimes when I have a poet. And the poet we're talking to, by the way, if you've just joined us, is Tracy K. Smith, and she's the author of Life on Mars and recipient of the 2012 Pulitzer Prize in Poetry. The universe is a house party. It's ours, you write. Which universe are we talking about? I'm reminded of an E. Cummings line, there's a hell of a universe next door, let's go. And we have all these universes now, don't we, to contend with?
I guess we do, yeah. Yeah, you know, I have to say that I think I've said this already, but when I first started thinking about space, it was really a way of imagining America. And I was kind of shocked at the way at the assumptions I made that the universe was an American place in a way. And I think that's where that poem, The Universe is a House Party, comes from. And I think it pokes fun at that sense of propriety.
You, in some ways, I suppose, poke fun at us, at our rather grandiose notions of ourselves when you say future that isn't what it used to be.
Yeah. I read on a blog somewhere that someone recognized that phrase from a bumper sticker, which is exactly where it came from for me. But some of those throwaway lines really do seem to capture our inability to articulate what we really feel in the face of big things. And I kind of like that.
Can you read another poem for us?
I'd love to.
How about, well, you pick it. the opening, I thought the opening was really interesting, the weather and space, before we actually get into the collection.
Sure. The weather and space. Is God being or pure force? The wind or what commands it? When our lives slow and we can hold all that we love, it sprawls in our laps like a gangly doll. When the storm kicks up and nothing is ours, we go chasing after all we're certain to lose, so alive, faces radiant with panic.
Do you feel comfortable being called a metaphysical poet? Because you are.
Yeah, I do feel. I feel very flattered being called that. I think we're metaphysical people. We don't often enter into that vocabulary, you know, in phone calls, emails. But I think we live in that space a large part of the day. And certainly it's the space that we turn to when we feel the weight of large feeling.
But you write about what I would call very commonplace and quotidian things as well. You have a poem about walking a dog.
Yeah. I guess if I were a filmmaker, I would probably try and get all of these different images into film. And since poetry is the medium that I work in, I just try and let everything happen. And, you know, you can imagine a poem, a collection of poems is something that's written over several years. And so a dog poem, you know, comes along, and then a few months later, a more ambitious poem kind of knocks at the door.
Who are the poets that you continue to be influenced by in your own work or that have had a major impact on you?
I love and I hate that question, but
I love and hate recently, to ask it, but I have to, yeah.
Yeah, of course. No, someone recently said, okay, you have 1 second, name the one poet that you whose work you couldn't live without. And Elizabeth Bishop came to my mind, and that was a little bit of a surprise. But I find her work so incredibly masterful and lasting. Her poems don't ever feel dated to me. And she's just so gifted at looking at the world and describing it and allowing the details of things to bring with them a sense of emotional stake and possibility. And I think her work is something that's deeply American and extremely beautiful.
No, I agree with you about Bishop. I think she's terrific, and she's gone way up in the literary stock exchange. Any particular poem of Bishop's? Because the one that's so often anthologized is that poem about the fish, but I think like A Miracle for Breakfast is an extraordinary poem.
God, I'm so bad at titles. But I really... God, you're going to make me feel embarrassed.
No, don't feel embarrassed. She's converged in your mind in a total, what do they call it, mind meld. So the titles don't seem to matter, nor necessarily should they. Well, they just tell us. How important are titles to you?
Well, they usually come for me after a poem is done, after I've been living in the world of the poem, and I say, okay, I have a few different options. I can call it as it is and give a straightforward title. That will maybe orient the reader to what he or she is going to experience, or I can have a little bit of fun and see if the title can bring in some different, a different lens through which to view the poem, something that wouldn't immediately come to mind.
I like that a daughter of a Hubble engineer says through a different lens. they had big problems with their lenses. You have a poem on writer's block, and ironically enough, I read that poem and then was looking at some emails from listeners, and one listener said, you did a program on writer's block. How can we get a hold of it? Most of these programs are in our archives, but that was many, many years ago. What has experiencing writer's block for you been like?
Oh, gosh. I've gone through different kinds of writer's block. When I was a little bit younger, I went through a total shutdown that was anxiety produced. I think I was so, as I mentioned, workshop is something that you want to perform. And I think I got to a place where I just couldn't. And I stopped writing for several months and picked up photography as a way of trying to keep myself alive in an image-based medium. Now, thankfully, I think the writer's block that I experience is just slowness, slowness getting out of the blocks. And I think that poem that you mentioned, Alternate Take, is really an attempt to say, okay, this is slow going. Let's just record each step of the way and see what that might lead to.
Well, I'd like you to read another poem for us, if you'd be so kind. And there are a couple I know that you expressed interest in reading. One was The Universe's Primal Scream, which opened section 4 of your volume, Life on Mars. And another one was When Your Small Form Troubled Into Me, which is, which one would you like to read?
How about The Universe's Primal Scream?
Okay.
5 p.m. on the nose. They open their mouths and it rolls out, high, shrill, and metallic. First the boy, then his sister. Occasionally, they both let loose at once, and I think of putting on my shoes to go up and see whether it is merely an experiment their parents have been conducting upon the good crystal, which must surely lie shattered to dust on the floor. Maybe the mother is still proud of the 4 pink lungs she nursed to such might. Perhaps if they hit the magic decibel, the whole building will lift off and will ride to glory like Elijah. If this is it, if this is what their cries are cocked toward, let the sky pass from blue to red to molten gold to black. Let the heaven we inherit approach. Whether it is our dead in Old Testament robes or a door opening onto the roiling infinity of space, whether it will bend down to greet us like a father or swallow us like a furnace, I'm ready to meet what refuses to let us keep anything for long, what teases us with blessings, bends us with grief. Wizard, thief, the great wind rushing to knock our mirrors to the floor, to sweep our short lives clean. How mean our racket seems beside it, my stereo on shuffle, the neighbor chopping onions through a wall. All of it just a hiccup against what may never come for us. And the kids upstairs still at it, screaming like the dawn of man, as if something they have no name for has begun to insist upon being born.
Wow. Thank you for that. It's, you bring in a lot of the mystery of human behavior and yet the possibility of agency. And it made me think, of course, of Arthur Janov, who gave us the whole notion of the primal scream. You're teaching creative writing now, and I want to ask you about that. Let me give out the phone number first, though, because I know there are some people who may want to respond to your poetry and have an opportunity to talk to you about it and simply talk to you and join our conversation. And if so, toll-free number you can join us at is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your call, so feel free to join us with Tracy K. Smith. Toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or you can go to our Facebook page. And can you really teach poetry? A lot of people often ask that. I mean, isn't it innate talent? Because you're doing
well. Students who have talent can learn from a workshop. And the students who may not go on to become poets, I think, become better readers as a result. But I definitely feel that there's something to be gained from having someone say, you've done this a lot in your poetry. Have you read this poet and have you tried this different approach?
And you teach with Joyce Carol Oates, right?
I do, yes.
Over there in Princeton. Again, feel free to join us. Like to hear your reactions to the poetry you've heard. And we're talking about poetry. And I'll ask that question to listeners. If you had to have just one poet you couldn't live without, who would it be? That's a question that fascinates me, and I'd like to hear from some of you on that as well. It's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page, and let's hear from you on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Tracy K. Smith, author of a volume of poetry called Life on Mars and winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize, also professor of creative writing at Princeton University. And before we went to the break, I was just talking about that perennial question about how much creative writing courses can actually spur what might be latent talent or actually even teach young people how to write poetry. I guess it's always been a question for me, Tracy, because I teach poetry. I teach literature. And I often feel that teaching it, well, can reach out to learn more about craft sometimes than just having workshops where young people read each other's poetry.
Oh, absolutely. And I love that that perspective informs your teaching of literature, too, because sometimes there's a sense of combat between reader and text. But I think that looking at things from a craft perspective invites you to, well, imitation is something that I really encourage my students to do. So imitate. But we always spend at least half the class discussing published poems. I think that's how you develop your sense of what poets do and what you might seek to do as a writer.
What do you think poetry does for us? You know, I always go back to the unacknowledged legislators. That's Shelley's line, and Auden even copped it years later. But do you think of yourself as an unacknowledged legislator?
Well, what I think poetry does is it gives us a different sense of lived experience or possible experience. And I think it does that in a lot of ways through metaphor, which can bring you close to something that you have no literal access to. I think that it allows us to have what, in my opinion, is a real encounter with another voice and another story and maybe even another world. And we come away from those kinds of encounters changed. We see the world that we do move through different eyes.
So it's like those vast, unreadable novels in many ways, isn't it? It has its own infinite source.
Yeah. I mean, I really believe that words can put a lot of things into motion just by giving us the language for describing thought and feeling, acknowledging thought and feeling in ways that are different and that take more time than real time allows.
Let's bring a caller on. Emily, welcome. You're on.
How are you?
Hi.
Hi. Just wanted to call and thank you. I'm a Princeton alumna leaving Berkeley, California. We've had an upstairs neighbor's children's issue for a little while, and your poem, not only astounding, made us feel not so alone in the universe anymore.
I'm glad to hear that. I think I'm now an upstairs neighbor, upstairs problem for my downstairs neighbors. I have a 2.5-year-old. So.
Well, didn't you write some of the poems in this collection while you were pregnant?
I did. I wrote many of them. And, you know, you talked about those mysteries. That was another big question in my mind. What am I in contact with right now, with this person? Who is she and where has she come from? I guess those are questions that come up a lot when we think about pregnancy. But
what's your daughter's name?
Naomi.
Naomi. And you knew she was going to be a she?
I did.
And she's given you a lot of joy.
She has, and she's changed my relationship to everything in ways that I'm so grateful for, that I wouldn't have been able to wish for beforehand.
Changed you as a poet as well?
To be honest, I don't know yet. I know that the questions that I have feel like they weigh something different with her in my life. And so I imagine that means my poems might be going after different kinds of things. But I've been working on prose since she's been born for the most part. So I don't know exactly what it's going to feel like to go back into the poetry bubble with this other person in my world.
Is it too soon for you to talk about what prose you're working on?
Well, I'll talk a little bit about it. It's a memoir that takes up, I guess, some of the things my poems in this book talk about in terms of family. I grew up in California in the 70s and 80s.
Where?
And Fairfield.
Oh, close and, by. Yeah.
Yeah, not far from you. And so thinking about the family that I was a part of and the relationship that I had to my parents' history, and now I also realize that race and religion were large questions that I didn't quite know that I was wrestling with at the time, but that I'm having a really interesting time moving back toward in prose.
How influenced were you by, say, African-American poets? I mean, not only contemporary, but, you know, going back to Langston Hughes and Claude McKay and Jean Toomer, those poets?
Mm-hmm. Well, those were poets whose voices I loved hearing. I loved reading their poetry aloud. And, you know, in literature classes, I loved, you know, analyzing those poems and thinking about the way that sound and history and tradition were being utilized and also pushed against or questioned. Those are not the voices that I feel that my writing is seeking to channel in terms of the voices that have taught me how I want to put words down on the page. But they've opened doors of possibility that I have to acknowledge.
Well, there's been an ongoing, I suppose, call it division about the purpose of poetry or literature from the black perspective, many saying it has to be political, and that was especially true during the 60s and 70s. And, Ralph Ellison probably said it best, if I wanted to be a sociologist, I'd write sociology, meaning I'm an artist above all. You take a stand on that?
Well, I feel very free in terms of, there's no obligation that I bend to. But I also feel that the issues that confound me as a human are things that I really want to think about in my poetry. And race plays a role in that, in as much as the way that we as people treat one another is a big theme in my work. I love that as an African-American poet, I have the opportunity to write about race and make overt connections to other writers who have done the same thing. And I also feel like I'm now in conversation with writers who are of different backgrounds who might be thinking about the same theme. Tony Hoagland is a white poet who has written a lot of poems about race, some of which are very contentious. But I think that conversation is something that we now feel more comfortable saying everyone's invited to. And I think that's something that is really characteristic of this particular moment in American poetry.
Again, we're talking to Tracy K. Smith, and you are invited to join us. 866-733-6786 is the number for your calls. Or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have contributing to this conversation on our website, which is kqed.org/forum, or go to our Facebook page. I'm going to ask Tracy, if you would, to read that poem I alluded to before, When Your Small Form Troubled Into Me.
Sure. It's actually When Your Small Form Tumbled Into Me.
Tumbled into me, excuse me, yes. That was a strange Freudian slip, but okay.
I use the verb troubled a lot with my students, so I think that's okay. When Your Small Form Tumbled Into Me. I lay sprawled like a big game rug across the bed, belly down, legs wishbone wide. It was winter, workaday. Your father swung his feet to the floor. The kids upstairs dragged something back and forth on shrieking wheels. I was empty, blown through by whatever swells, swirling, and then breaks night after night upon that room. You must have watched for what felt like forever, wanting to be what we passed back and forth between us like fire, wanting weight, desiring desire, dying to descend into flesh. Fault, the brief ecstasy of being. From what dream of world did you wriggle free? What soared and what grieved when you aimed your will at the yes of my body, alive like that on the sheets?
That's a pretty sexy poem. I like it. Are you, a listener called in a minute ago and said, is she a product of the California public schools? You are, aren't you?
I absolutely am. Yeah.
And how do you think the schools did for you as far as teaching language and poetry or approaching a literary education?
I feel really lucky. I remember so many teachers that were just wonderful in terms of giving us access to great literature and giving us a sense of agency and wisdom. I remember, I was in the fifth grade and writing a poem in response to maybe a Mark Twain story that I had read. And my teacher said, that's important. And that's a good poem. You have something to say. And I think I never let go of that bit of encouragement and never stopped thinking that I was somebody who had a voice that I should use.
Are you going to use that in conjunction with the Pulitzer? I mean, in other words, really what I'm getting back to some of the poet laureates like Bob Haas and Kay Ryan, who both happen to be from this area as well, who felt it was almost their obligation, really, to teach not only youngsters to be apprised of poetry and its delights, but also to give them an opportunity to express themselves through poetry.
I think it is really important. I love, and not just youngsters. I taught a poetry workshop for senior citizens recently who didn't consider themselves writers and was just so inspired and delighted by the stories that they had and the sense of memory that they were able to access. I think poetry is something that we really and truly can't or shouldn't live without. I think it affects us as individuals and as citizens, and I do feel like that's something, a mission, you know, I'd like to take on to make sure that there are more people who come in contact with this thing that's of such importance.
Imaginary toads in real gardens, to quote Marianne Moore. And here's Jeffrey, who writes on our website, as a fan of poetry, soul, and Battlestar Galactica, I am so glad to learn of your guest poetry. Thank you. It reminds me, I wanted to ask you whether you were familiar with a poem by Adrienne Rich called Planetarium?
I'm not, actually.
Well, it is a poem that takes us into novas and outer space and stuff like you do, but she's also, it's an important poem in elevating the role of women historically. Carolyn Herschel, in fact, who made some discoveries but didn't get the credit for them. How important are those kinds of things to you as a woman in your poetry?
Yeah, I think that when I first imagined myself as a speaker, maybe now I'll go back to Bishop and that wonderful poem in The Waiting Room where she says, I was an I, an Elizabeth. I think what I first felt so connected to was just the inner self that maybe existed within or outside of gender and any other allegiances. And that's something that poetry gave me. But I feel like I'm moving past that, and I want to understand what the particular vantage point of race and gender and nationality provides and what that can lead me to or maybe sometimes try to keep me from in language.
Well, sometimes it can get tricky. I was thinking about Adrienne Rich again because she became very politicized in her poetry and committed to that. And I think it got too didactic, at least for my taste.
I think that
there's a danger there, I think, isn't there?
Yeah. The danger is... Well, there are a couple of dangers, and one is that sometimes people don't want to listen, and that I don't think that should necessarily be a deterrent, and I think that for Adrienne Rich that wasn't. And, of course, there are people that do and did. But I also feel like with other poets, the danger with becoming extremely politicized is that it might become very easy to draw a line between the us who are intrinsically right and the them who are intrinsically wrong. And if you're pointing across a line like that, then a poem does become something that feels didactic and that feels premeditated. But if there's a way of troubling that space a little bit and saying, to what extent am I able, even uncomfortably, to empathize with a them, then the act of writing about political issues can become extremely fruitful, I think, and surprising and scary in a very positive way.
Here's a listener named Teresa who writes, Poet I cannot live without, Jim Carroll. He taught me that words work on more than a single level. And here's Joe from Vallejo joining us. Joe, welcome. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. This is a really great conversation. I really wanted to talk about what is your feelings about slam poetry and poetry that's written to be performed, because I found that sometimes there's a little bit of a difference between poets who write for readers to read and consume the poetry that way, or poets who write just to perform it for people in an audience.
Yeah, that's a great question, and there is a difference. I think that with a poem that is going to have a life in the air, in performance. It has access to so many different things that a poem on the page doesn't, right? And one of them is that voice. The living voice is going to be the medium through which the poem will reach a listener. And it's not just a listener, it's a viewer. There's a theatrical element of the presentation that brings emotion and that creates pacing and makes the music of the poem something that is unmistakable. And I think that's wonderful. And then a poem that might typically have a life on the page has to do other things in order to maintain that feeling of being alive. And so some of those things, you know, have to do with producing music through other means, momentum and repetition or form or will behave differently on the page. But what I think is really exciting is that we're in a moment where the line between those two modes is very blurry. And so we have poets like Patricia Smith or Patrick Rosal, who are amazing performance poets and who have done slam poetry, but who are also writing these books of poems that don't abandon the sense of music and energy and voice, but that come alive for a reader on the page again and again as well. And I think that's something that's really wonderful.
Do you like rap poetry and slam poetry and hip-hop poetry, all those different neo-forms of poetry?
Yeah, I do. And I think they allow different things to happen. And when they're done well, I think that any kind of poetry is important and beautiful. I love the idea, you know.
My Even work doggerel? Does,
well, it's hard to do doggerel well. But I think that, you know, the poem as a vehicle for an idea is something that I think is invaluable. And so if a hip-hop poem is going to be a vehicle for a particular idea and it's explored in a way that gets to some kind of discovery, then I think it's successful.
And we go next to Scott. Scott, you're on Forum. Good morning.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to say how wonderful it is to listen to our poet here today. And I was just thinking that she reminds me of this kind of noble huntress who finds herself in a game preserve hunting a prey which she cannot see, which leaves no tracks, but you know it abides within the preserve, and you still keep on hunting it.
That's quite poetic in its own right, Scott. he's got you as Diana the Huntress there, Tracy Kingsman.
Right.
Well, you know, and it seems like a common thread in many of her poems that she is surrounding really large concepts which cannot be named, but you do a wonderful job at naming them.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. And Maya writes on our website, thank you for sharing your lovely poems. I just requested Life on Mars from my library. Look forward to exploring your work. A question was asked about what single poet one returns to. That's a hard question for me to answer. I can narrow it down to three: E. Cummings, Theodore Rithke, and Sharon Olds. Your work reminds me somewhat of hers. Have you been told that before about Sharon Olds?
I actually haven't, but I
good company.
Love her work.
Yeah,
I love her work and the courage of it. And again, she's such a master of metaphor and image. And I feel like those are tools that I lean hard on in my writing.
She's also a good guest. We've had her on here on Forum. Another listener writes, to quote William Carlos Williams, it is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die miserably every day for lack of what is found there. And my favorite poet, by a country mile, William Shakespeare. And we'll go to another caller, and that's you, Wolfram. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I guess my question is how to get over your bad poetry. I had a high school teacher that said my poetry lacked felicity. And then later in life, I'm a sculptor, and I thought of including poetry with my exhibit of sculpture. My mother, who happens to be a great poet, she said, well, honey, there's no point in including bad poetry with good sculpture. So I imagine every, you know, poet has had early experiences that kind of stunt your poetic aspirations. I'm just wondering what you recommend to get over your bad poetry.
Well, yeah, we all have had those experiences. I had a pretty devastating response to my graduate thesis that kind of shut me up for a little while. But I had to acknowledge that there were questions I had that I needed to explore in my own voice. And that brought me back to the page. But you know what else is really important is reading. I think that we learn so much, even if we're not aware of it, from reading a variety of poets, not just the poets whose work calls to us that we love on a really instinctive level, but the poets whose work challenges us. And if you can articulate to yourself why it's challenging or why it's off-putting, that can also be a lesson to you. I learn a lot from the poets whose work I teach as well, and I think that teaching asks you to read with a different kind of agency and a different kind of attention.
I know one way the caller can feel better. Just get a hold of the anthology, The Stuffed Owl, which is bad poetry. I mean, he may have been told he's infelicitous as a poet, but the poetry in there is so bad that it'll make any bad poet feel good. What was your graduate thesis on?
Oh, it was a creative writing thesis.
Of poetry.
And, of poetry. And a lot of those poems were thinking – my mother had passed away when I was 22. And so most of the poems in that collection were thinking about her. And they were probably written right on the heels of that loss and without enough time for the distance to set in and bring clarity.
Listener writes – poet I can't live without, Mary Oliver, especially the poem Wild Geese. I feel she expresses some of the primal connection discussed by your guest. Have you read much of Mary Oliver?
I have read some of Mary Oliver's work. I had a student many years ago who adored her work and introduced it to me, which is another great side effect of teaching, actually. Your students can become teachers of you in a certain way.
Yeah, I like a lot of her work, too. You're listening to Forum, and we're talking to Tracy K. Smith, this year's Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let's go to Tom in Los Gatos. You're on. Hi.
Hey, great show, Michael. It's really an honor to talk to two great poets today, modern poets.
I'm not a poet, Tom.
Well, I teach poetry, so I don't see how you could get around it. But anyway, my favorite poet, even better, I think, than William Shakespeare, the previous person was mentioning, is Maya Lin. She's not only a great artist, but she's, I think, the premier poet. She brings all the best of the East and West into the Vietnam Memorial, which was a poem in progress. You know, as each name was put on the wall, each person, of course, had a huge story or volume of poetry in their own life and their families and neighbors and friends' lives and so on. So it's an infinite poem, like space, like the scream in space where the little babies with the pink lungs are like lifting off into outer space, looking at the black slash there, the marble. It's like looking at outer space in the genetic poetic code of our whole race. It would look just as good on bars or the moon, or floating in space, as it does, in Washington D.C. So I think she deserves a UN prize for poetry.
Well, Maya Lin is a visual artist. In fact, we interviewed her on Forum a number of years ago. It brings up an interesting question, though, Tracy K. Smith, and that is how much is the visual imagery around you? You know, other than Hubble spacecraft shots and everything, but painting and visual art affect your poetry?
I think that I have a natural affinity for film that comes into my work quite a lot in visual terms. I don't know that a reader sees it, but that it's part of my process. When I get to a place where I'm trying to build a space, a scene, even a gesture, I sort of stop and ask myself, if I were a camera, if I were making the silent film version of this poem, how would I depict it? And I think that helps me to look at image as a way of bringing narrative in very quickly and allowing, you know, what Eliot calls the objective correlative to happen in a poem, whereby what is seen brings with it a sense of what is felt.
So you believe in the objective correlative, huh?
I do. Hey, speaking of Maya Lin, Yusef yes. Komunyakaa has a really wonderful poem about looking at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial called Facing It, which maybe that listener would like to read.
And Maya Lin is from Athens, Ohio, where I was educated many, many years ago. And I think her father was a professor at Ohio University. So there are all kinds of connections in this universe we live in. Jim, let's connect to you, our next caller. Hi.
Hi, it's a pleasure to meet a poet. I have a particular interest in this because our daughter, finishing her freshman year at Wesleyan, is a poet and has been writing poetry ever since she was quite small. And the path that she's following is sort of similar to yours in that she, you know, even as a junior high school kid, would sit in on the Stanford Stegner Fellow readings and did them all the way through high school until she finally found a spot that she thought, you know, where she could learn more poetry.
Well, excuse me, Jim, I think you were a Stegner Fellow, weren't you, Tracy?
Not me.
No, Tracy, our guest.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, I
was.
I just want to get that on the record. Please, go ahead, Jim.
Right. Anyway, her experience was a little bit different than yours in that she looked with quite a lot of effort to try to find mentors around here to help her with her poetry, and she ended up spending almost 6 years with one of the creative writing fellows at Stanford. And even though she went to a pretty good, private high school here in the Valley, there's not much in the way of creative writing, and certainly it was more about math and science and blah, 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 instead of creative writing. And so she now is at a place, I think, where there are poets, and one poet in particular that she kind of made her decide to go to that school.
After. Jim, Stanford has amped up, I just have to say this in defense, has amped up its creative writing program to quite a degree, I think, just in the last couple of years. Not only the Stegner program, but Adam Johnson is there and Tobias Wolff is there, and they really have, some fine writers. I met recently, in fact, with someone representing both the creative writing and English departments. But I think there's a question here, isn't there? We've got seconds left about your daughter.
I guess there's not really. Oh, yes. The question is, I think she, and I wonder why this is true. She's 19 and you're a little bit older than she is, and you seem to have a real self-awareness of what is behind your poetry. I mean, you have certain social issues that come to the front in complete sentences. She writes with amazing, I've been told, perspicacity, and it's all sound and image-driven work that she simply is impelled to sit down and write, and so the imagery comes back and or comes forth and kind of gives the context for what the subject matter is.
But Jim, I got to jump in here because we're running out of time. I want Tracy to respond to you.
I think I hear what you're saying. You're wondering when the material is going to find your daughter or when she'll find it. And I would say that a lot of writers start out with the desire and ability to say something, and then it takes a little while for that material that really moves you to reach you. And I think if she's 19 and she's doing what she's doing, she's in an amazing place. I'm, more than twice her age, and I feel like, if I had known the number of poets that she seems to know now when I was her age, I would have felt completely blessed. So I think you should just be proud.
We could be proud of having you on. Thank you for being with us. Enjoyed it.
Thank you so much.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.